This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Manoj Eshetu, Executive Director of the Refugee Women's Alliance, a Seattle-based, award-winning, nationally recognized nonprofit that provides holistic services to help refugee and immigrant women and families thrive. Manoj Eshetu is here to tell us about the work of the Refugee Women's Alliance and meeting the challenges for refugees and immigrants in the current political environment. Welcome, Manoj.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Why was the Refugee Women's Alliance founded? What is your history?
Well, it has a very interesting background. RWA started by the desire and the hard work of a refugee woman, Vietnamese, who came from Vietnam. She was a teacher in Vietnam. She became successful, and then she recruited her daughter and a couple of her friends and started RWA. At that time, it was called SEWAS, Southeast Pacific Women Alliance. The intent was to teach English language to refugees and immigrants. And later on, they saw a need because the women who were coming over there, they needed childcare, so they added the childcare. Later on, they realized that there was a great need for domestic violence help because people who are coming from different countries, they have different laws over there, and we have different laws in the United States. So domestic violence established. And as time went by, over the past 32 years, we added different programs. We realized that refugees and immigrants come to this country to build a better lives for themselves. They come in search of democracy and freedom, and fleeing from oppressive governments, dictatorship, wars, traumas. They come here to build a better life, and they want to gain self-sufficiency as soon as possible. So we established different employment programs because number one thing for a refugee who comes to this country is to find employment. So we have developed several different employment programs. We teach them how to look for a job, how to write resume, how to interview. We also have different child training program, such as childcare training, such as basic food training, so that people can find jobs who don't have a lot of skills and they have in very early stages of learning English can find jobs in these areas. So then we develop youth development program or department that helps refugees and immigrants, youth, for after school programs. We are present in different high school. We are also present in Seattle World School, and we have classes in our main building and in two of our locations in South Seattle. So we provide math and science, and we provide enrichment classes to the youth because they don't have the opportunity that the mainstream kids have to develop to be a whole person. In addition to what they learn in college, maybe they learn different sports, maybe they learn different vocational things that they like. So in addition to that, early childhood education is gaining really popularity, and we are becoming very successful in that. Right now, we serve about 125 children from 0 to age 5. It's a Head Start and preschool and, you know, early childcare. What we teach is in dual languages. So we call it a bilingual. So the children from the inception, when they come over there, and 2 days a week, the teachers will speak to them in different language, Chinese and Vietnamese, and 2 days a week they talk to them in English. So they learn the two languages because we believe that a door to a culture is learning the language. And the parents get interested to learn the languages as well. We are teaming up with Lehigh, it's low-income housing development, to be in their location when they're building right now in Lake City. We will be there, and we serve 80 additional children. We're hoping to offer 3 different languages over there. We also have behavioral health, not because the refugees and immigrants are coming with, you know, severe schizophrenic or mental disease, because of the stress that they're going through, because of maybe they have post-traumatic disorder, because of, you know, when they come to this country, they come with nothing on their back and they don't know English and they don't know about the system. They don't have a network. So the stress is too much. So we have licensed behavioral health practitioners as well as social workers who work with them to find housing, find employment, find, you know, in the schools where you need to go to get the health care and all that. where do you need to take a bus, transportation, everything that they need, we try to provide them in sort of a holistic system, a holistic approach, so that they could integrate, assimilate, acculturate as soon as possible. They can stand on their feet and be self-sufficient. So we also have immigration naturalization services that helps refugees, because refugees are legal individuals and families when they come over here, but they don't have the permanent residency status. We have an attorney on our side, immigration attorney, and two BIA accredited and a couple of other staff who help them get prepared for green card and for citizenship when they're ready. We provide different workshops during the year to make sure that the needs of refugees are taken care of. In our youth program and in our childcare program as well, we also have parent education. We educate parents how to work with the school system and how to teach their children what to expect in the United States. So we try to provide everything that kind of make it easier for refugees and immigrants to survive and to build a stronger future for themselves.
Could you highlight the differences between immigrants and refugees?
I'm happy to do that. Immigrants, I am an example of an immigrant. Immigrants come here with education or, you know, maybe sometimes some money with them to start a business or something. In my case, I was a student in here when Iranian Revolution happened. And so Iran was transformed from a very oppressive regime, dictatorship, into a much more oppressive dictatorship. My parents called us and said, you know, we came as a student and we were on a student visa. I was going to grad school. My sister was going to architectural school. And they said, don't come back because this country is not going to be the same country that you grew up with. There's no future in here for you. So we stayed here. But again, we abandoned our families, our network, everything that we had over there. But we stayed here because we believed in the freedom and democracy of the United States and the Constitution. It wasn't as hard as it is for refugees and immigrants. It was hard, though, when, again, you're not with your family and all that. So after a while, I got married and my husband, who was an Ethiopian, but he was a citizen, he had a citizenship, and through him, I got a green card, which is permanent residency. So permanent residency will allow you to stay in the United States for as long as you want. You have every right as a citizen, except that you cannot vote. Now, refugees are coming to the United States in a legal visa. They have a refugee status, but they're not immigrant. They don't have permanent residency. Mostly refugees and immigrants stay in the camps, refugee camps, for anywhere from 2 to 5 years. So during this process, they're vetted by 5 different agencies, by United Nations, by Department of Homeland Security, by FBI, and a couple of other agencies. And then they're granted the refugee status. They come over here. The first 3 months, they come over here and they stay with refugee resettlement agencies through them. So they have, during the first 3 months, they provide housing, they provide healthcare and all their needs for 3 months. After the 3 months, they're on their own. So then that's where, you know, organizations like us come into play, help them build a better life for themselves, to get the permanent residency, because that refugee status, they need to start working from day one and they need to apply for permanent residency. So once they become permanent residents, then they can stay here for as long as they want to, and they have every right except the right to vote. After 5 years, if they have the ability to pass the citizenship exam, then they're allowed to become citizens.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Manaz Ishatu, Executive Director of the Refugee Women's Alliance, a Seattle-based, award-winning, nationally recognized nonprofit that provides holistic services to help refugees and immigrant women and families thrive. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. How many refugees and immigrants do we have here in King County and also in Washington State?
I know that there is about 25% of the population of King County are refugees and immigrants. In 2016, United States admitted about 85,000 refugees, or about 85,000 refugees. Out of that, Washington State received somewhere around 3,000. So Washington used to rank number 2, but in the past few years ranked number 8 or 9 amongst the states who were accepting refugees. I think now we're going back to be the number two or number one because we are the sanctuary state.
And looking within King County, where are most of the refugees and immigrants living?
Depending on where they're coming from. So, you know, for instance, the East African communities live in South King County or Southeast King County. If you look at, you know, Middle Easternian, they're more on the east side, and then some of them are just integrated all over. Because the housing affordability is becoming more difficult for refugees to even find housing. And one of the functions that RIVO does is trying to find housing for refugees and immigrants. And that the Office of Refugee Immigrant in the state are trying to send them to different areas of the state, Spokane, Pierce County. So they're going more towards east and towards south, that which is more affordable for refugees.
Well, you've alluded a bit to this already, but what are the key barriers or challenges for immigrants and refugees?
Number one barrier is the language. Number two is understanding the systems and understanding where things are and finding employment. Now, refugees and immigrants come with different job skills and different English proficiency and different education. We have refugees who are coming from rural areas of some countries that they're even illiterate in their own language. But we also have refugees that are coming from Middle East and from different areas, Europe, Russian, Ukraine, who are educated. Right now, amongst our staff, I hired two East African doctors, medical doctors. We don't provide medical services. However, we hired them as caseworkers to work with refugees and immigrants. And they will do that during this period that they're getting ready to take the board exam, or one of them has decided that he wants to get a master's degree and forget about medicine. We also have a MD, PhD who we hired at our behavioral health as a case manager who is waiting to take his board exam. So there are different challenges depending on where you're coming from with what skills and education. So the barriers, you know, again, finding housing right now, if we are talking about King County, finding housing is really important. Finding employment is really important. Finding good healthcare system that can work for you is a barrier. We are helping with all of that. We have a gamut of social services programs that we try to help refugees and immigrants to, you know, get them through all of these issues and remove the barriers for them.
Would you say a bit more about the clients of the Women's Refugee Alliance? For example, how many different languages are spoken, and are your clients representative of immigrants as a whole, or are there certain groups that tend to come to you?
The way we differentiate ourselves from others is that we serve every refugee and immigrant from all over the continent. So our staff, we hire from within the communities that we serve. So we hire bilingual staff. At RIVO, we speak over 50 different languages and over 60-some different dialects. And we have 133 staff, and we have 500 volunteers every year who are coming from mainstream group to help us, you know, help refugees and immigrants. So majority of, I would say 90-95% of our staff are refugees and immigrants, and about over 65% of our board of directors are immigrants.
What steps are you taking as an organization in regard to public policy for refugees and immigrants?
One of the main aspects of our mission is advocacy on behalf of refugees and immigrants. So what we do every year, we take about 1,000 people to the Capitol, to Olympia, to meet with legislators and to talk about their issues. You know, we summarize the issues that they're facing. We train them how to go and talk to the representative. It is really good for them to know that democracy exists and you can talk to your representatives. They don't have that chance to do that in their own, you know, or they didn't when they were living in their own countries. And also for the representatives to see that these are normal human beings who are coming here in search of not only a better life, but in search of democracy and freedom. And we work with different legislators. We work with the city, the county, the governor. Right now, we have been so lucky to live in a city and a state that is a sanctuary. We benefit from the governor's actions, appointing the state as a sanctuary state. We have a great mayor who is in support of refugees and immigrants and is in support of equality for all, and announced that the city of Seattle is also a sanctuary city. We have an executive, King County executive, who is really in support of refugees and immigrants. So since the election, there has been a lot of meeting between the office of the mayor, the King County executive, the governor's office, and the service providers like RIWA, people who are serving refugees and immigrants, people who are coming from different faith-based organizations, to see how we can ease that pressure and that uncertainty in the lives of refugees and immigrants. And so we've been meeting continuously. We've been at RIWA and a couple of other our sister organizations that are larger organizations. We've been providing workshops around the rights of refugees and immigrants. Know your right, that, you know, don't be worried that they're going to pick you up from the street and, you know, send you back to your country. We see a lot of anxiety and a lot of uncertainty amongst the refugees and also immigrants, you know, also even citizens who weren't born in here, but mainly refugees who were subject to a lot of hate crime. We see that even some of my staff were wearing their custom clothing and wearing hijab because of their faith and because of their culture. A couple of my staff have been subject to road rage, that people were trying to push them out of the road. We had clients who were stopping at the bus station and experienced somebody yelling at them and asking them to go back to your home country and we don't want you here, or take your scarf out of your head. And then when she said that I'm a permanent resident, they said, well, if I see you in here, I'm going to kill you. Take your scarf out. I mean, those kind of things that people are facing right now. Also, there's uncertainty amongst the youth. Youth and children are feeling a lot of pressure. We were in one meeting with King County, and one youth stood up from East African community, and she said that when I'm a representative of my community, and I want to explain that we feel like less of a human being. We feel that we don't exist anymore. We feel a lot of pressure. We feel that people are looking at us differently. And we also hear from our staff who are working with youth that they're very worried that they're going to be separated from their parents and being sent to their countries, to their original countries, or somebody may take them away and separate them from their families. So there's a lot of anxiety amongst the youth, amongst the children, in addition to the adults, which I think it's really important for us to pay attention, especially to youth and children, because, you know, I read somewhere that the children are like a wet asphalt. So whatever falls on them makes an impression. So how do we make their life a little bit easier? Our teachers in public schools are not used to this type of uncertainty. They don't know how to deal with children who are really stressed out and they have questions, what's going to happen to me? Or if they see that other children are making the hate remarks or verbally abuse them, they don't know how to deal with that. So there's a lot of work to be done in that area. Also, when a lot of refugees and immigrants, when they're faced with hate crime, they're scared of reporting it to the police because they think they're going to be in trouble. And we see that a lot in a lot of East African communities, that, you know, they're scared of reporting. So we're providing all these workshops. We work with NERP, Northwest Immigration Rights Group, and we team up with other agencies to provide these workshops. And also our attorney participates in that, to teach them that you have a right in the United States. Yeah, there could be an executive order, there could be a ban, but we have democracy and there are other people who are behind you and there are laws in here that we go through that are supporting you. So these are the things that we've been doing, and it's a lot of work, but we're happy to do it. We hope that we will gain back our democracy and our democracy will not be compromised by certain action, a certain executive order.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Fanaz Eshetu, Executive Director of the Refugee Women's Alliance, a Seattle-based award-winning nationally recognized nonprofit that provides holistic services to help refugees and immigrant women and families thrive. How can listeners help support refugees and immigrants?
You know, they can support in many ways. We are also so lucky. In one extreme, we see the hatred and the hate crimes. You know, I think that even a verbal abuse is an abuse. But at one extreme, people are going through that. But on the other extreme, we had an outpour of support, phone calls. People are sending funding. People are coming and asking us, how can we help? And thank you for asking that. Anyone can help. You can go to our website. And if you have convictions about different programs, support that program by the way of helping us financially. You could volunteer. You could, you know, say something when you see that somebody is committing a hate crime, verbally abusing someone because of the way that they're dressing or the way that they look. So you could be helpful, but again, just like you did in the past few weeks and months, to stood by us and really let our voices be heard.
So what is the best way to deal with a situation with hate crimes to prevent them from happening?
I think we can do that by education. I mean, the fear of unknown, you know, people don't, probably they never had an experience to work with, to know a refugee and an immigrant. Once they have that, once they have that opportunity to learn about their lives, once they have an opportunity to be a neighbor to them, or they have an opportunity to read or learn about it, I think that fear will go away because a lot of it is fear of unknown.
What are the plans of the Women's Refugee Alliance for the future?
We are expanding our childcare program because, as I said, we feel that the language is a door opener to a culture. We also hope that we would be a stronger organization that can withstand all the uncertainties of the future, because even though we are a sanctuary city and sanctuary state, our funding is, you know, at jeopardy because some of our funding are federal funds. So if those federal funds are cut through the state and through the city, most of our program and contracts are supported by them, then we will be affected. We hope that we don't have to go through that, and we hope that we continue building culturally appropriate services to help refugees and immigrants who are coming from all over the world. Now, the face of refugees and immigrants every year changes. Sometimes we have more East African, sometimes we have more Middle Eastern. Right now, we have more Middle East coming. In the past few years, there were much more East African. The Iranians are coming now. Last year, we got about 113 of them. Syrians, Iraqis. So we hope that we continue providing that multicultural, multilingual services and culturally appropriate services and be able to be responsive to the needs of refugees and immigrants and make sure that they gain self-sufficiency as soon and as fast as possible so that they could build a better life for themselves and be a better neighbor for their neighbors.
So you mentioned federal funding. Where else does your funding come from?
Majority of our funding is through the federal and city and state contracts. We are also supported by private foundations and individual donors. In the past, United Way is one of our strongest funders, and they've been great supporter of our programs as well. And also we have other private foundations who have been helping us, individual donors. We are building the individual donors because we didn't have the opportunity to do that in the past. But right now, I think with the outpouring of support, we really rely on individual donors. I also hope that there are in the state, which we have so many really strong corporations. There are many of our strong corporations that are led by immigrants. I know in my community, there are a few, like Expedia is led by an Iranian immigrant. Microsoft is led by an Indian immigrant. And many others, you know, I can name them, but I don't, you know, have it in front of me. But we hope that the CEOs of companies that are led by immigrants will take more active role to help us if now and then later on, if the federal funds are cut and we are going through that uncertainty.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
The message that I want to leave for the listeners is that the refugees and immigrants are not coming here to commit a crime. They are the most vetted individuals and families who are coming to the United States. If they're fleeing from the same repressive dictatorships that we're fighting against, so don't think of them as the people who are coming here to commit crimes, or don't think of them as terrorists because they're not. They're coming here to build a better life for themselves, to take refuge and safety, and they're coming here in search of freedom, democracy, that our country represents. In my own experience, when I had to stay in the United States because of the change of the regime, many of my friends and family and relatives, they went to different European countries. We decided to stay in the United States because we learned about the democracy and the Constitution of the United States. We learned that there's equal opportunity for everyone, that everyone has a right to build a better life for themselves. What I'd like to ask everyone is to help refugees and immigrants build that better life for themselves and be a better neighbor and continue your support as you were doing in the past.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here. I appreciate it.
You were just listening to Manaz Eshetu, Executive Director of the Refugee Women's Alliance. For more information, check on the web at reba.org. Again, that's reba.org. Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and on kexp.org.